Crusades Through Arab Eyes by Alin Maalouf, continued. Cassette 4, side 2. He sent agitators to Baghdad to organize a riot similar to that which Ibn al-Kassab had fomented in 1111, thus forcing Sultan Mas'ud to send troops to Shaizar. He then wrote to all the emirs of Syria and Jazeera, calling upon them, with appropriate accompanying threats, to commit all their forces to driving back this new invasion. The army of the Atabeg himself, far less numerous than that of the enemy, avoided any frontal attack and instead started to harass the enemy. Meanwhile, Zangi initiated an intense correspondence with the Basileus and the Frankish commanders. He informed the emperor, and this was in fact true, that his allies feared him and were impatiently awaiting his departure from Syria. He then sent messages to the Frange, in particular to Jocelyn of Edessa and Raimond of Antioch. "Do you not understand," he asked them, "that if the Rum occupied a single stronghold in Syria, they would soon seize all your cities?" He dispatched numerous agents, most of them Christians of Syria, to mingle among the rank and file Byzantines and Frange. Their task was to spread demoralizing rumors about the approach of gigantic armies coming to the rescue from Persia, Iraq, and Anatolia. This propaganda had its effect, especially among the Frange, while the Basileus, wearing his golden helmet, personally directed the firing of the catapults. The lords of Edessa and Antioch sat in their tents and played interminable games of dice. This pastime, popular back in pharaonic Egypt, was equally widespread throughout East and West in the 12th century. The Arabs called it alza, a word the Frange adopted to designate not the game itself, but chance, hazard. It was a resounding victory for Zangi. The Atabeg now appeared as a savior throughout the Arab world, where the alliance of the Rum and the Frange had caused great dread. Naturally, he was now determined to use his prestige to seek a quick solution to a number of problems that had been gnawing at him. In the first place, the question of Homs. At the end of May, as soon as the Battle of Shaizar ended, Zangi reached a curious agreement with Damascus. He would marry the princess Zumurud and receive the city of Homs as a dowry. 3 months later, the mother who had murdered her own son arrived with an entourage to join formally with her new husband. Guests at the ceremony included representatives of the Sultan and of the Caliphs of Baghdad and Cairo, and even ambassadors sent by the Rum, who, having experienced Zangi's displeasure, had decided to maintain more friendly relations with him. Now that he'd become master of Mosul, Aleppo, and all of central Syria, the Atabeg set himself the objective of taking Damascus too, with the aid of his new wife. He hoped that she would be able to convince her son Mahmud to hand over his capital without a fight. The princess hesitated, stalled. Once he found that he could not rely on her, Zangi abandoned her. But in July 1139, while in Harran, he received an urgent message from Zumurud. Mahmud had just been assassinated, stabbed to death in his bed by 3 of his slaves. The princess begged her husband to march on Damascus without delay to take the city and punish her son's murderers. The Atabeg set out immediately. Although not indifferent to the tears of his wife, he mainly believed that the death of Mahmud could be used finally to unite all Syria under his authority. That was to reckon without the immortal Huna, who had returned to Damascus after the cession of Homs and had taken personal charge of the city's affairs upon the death of Mahmud. Expecting an offense by Zangi, Muhin al-Din quickly worked out a secret plan to deal with it. For the moment, however, he left the plan in abeyance and sought of the city's defense. Zangi did not march directly on the city he coveted. He began by attacking the ancient Roman town of Baalbek, the only agglomeration of any importance still held by the Damascenes. His intention was to encircle the Syrian metropolis and simultaneously to demoralize its defenders. In August, he set up 14 mangonels around Baalbek, which he then pounded relentlessly, hoping that he would be able to take the city in just a few days and then begin the siege of Damascus before summer was out. Baalbek itself capitulated with little resistance, but the defenders of the citadel, built with stones taken from an ancient temple of the Phoenician god Baal, held out for 2 long months. Zangi became so irritated that when the garrison finally surrendered at the end of October, after being assured that their lives would be spared, he ordered the crucifixion of 37 fighters and had the commander burned alive. This act of savagery, meant to convince the Damascenes that any resistance would amount to suicide, had just the opposite effect. Solidly united behind Khuna, the population of the Syrian metropolis was more determined than ever to fight to the end. In any case, it would soon be winter, and Zangi could not contemplate any serious attack before spring. Khuna would use these few months of respite to perfect his secret plan. In April 1140, as the Atabeg stepped up his pressure and prepared for a general attack, Khuna decided that the time had come to implement his plan. He would ask the army of the Frange, under the command of King Fulk, to come to the rescue of Damascus. This was not to be a one-off operation, but the inauguration of a proper treaty of alliance that would last beyond the death of Zangi. Indeed, back in 1138, Khuna had sent his friend the chronicler Usama ibn Munqid to Jerusalem to explore the possibility of Franco-Damascene collaboration against the master of Aleppo. Well received by the Frange, Usama had worked out the principles of an accord. Once embassies were established, the chronicler returned to the holy city at the beginning of 1140, carrying detailed proposals with him. The Frankish army would force Zangi to withdraw from the vicinity of Damascus. The forces of the two states would unite in the event of any fresh danger. Mohin al-Din would pay 20,000 dinars to defray military expenses. Finally, a joint expedition would be mounted under Khuna's command to occupy the fortress of Bani Yas, which had recently fallen into the hands of one of Zangi's vassals, and to restore it to the King of Jerusalem. As a demonstration of good faith, the Damascenes would send the Frange hostages selected from the families of major city dignitaries. In practice, all this amounted to living under a Frankish protectorate, but the population of the Syrian metropolis was resigned to it. Frightened by the Atabeg's brutal methods, they unanimously approved the treaty negotiated by Khuna, whose policy proved undeniably effective. Fearing that he would be caught in a pincer movement, Zangi withdrew to Baalbek, where he entrusted as a fiefdom to a reliable man, Ayyub, father of Saladin. He then headed north with his army, promising Ayyub that he would soon return to avenge this setback. After the departure of the Atabeg, Khuna occupied Bani Yas and handed it over to the Frange in accordance with the terms of the treaty. He then made an official visit to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Usama, who had become the leading Damascene specialist on Frankish affairs, went with him. Fortunately for us, this emir chronicler did more than simply participate in diplomatic negotiations. He had an inquisitive mind and was a keen observer who left us unforgettable testimony about mores and daily life during the times of the Frange. When I was visiting Jerusalem, I used to go to Al-Aqsa Mosque, where my Templar friends were staying. Along one side of the building was a small oratory in which the Frange had set up a church. The Templars placed this spot at my disposal that I might say my prayers. One day I entered, said Allahu Akbar, and was about to begin my prayer, when a man, a Frange, threw himself upon me, grabbed me, and turned me toward the east, saying, "Thus do we pray." The Templars rushed forward and led him away. I then set myself to prayer once more, but this same man, seizing upon a moment of inattention, threw himself upon me yet again, turned my face to the east, and repeated once more, "Thus do we pray." Once again the Templars intervened, led him away, and apologized to me, saying, "He is a foreigner. He has just arrived from the land of the Frange, and he has never seen anyone pray without turning to face east." I answered that I had prayed enough and left, stunned by the behavior of this demon who had been so enraged at seeing me pray while facing the direction of Mecca. If the emir Usama did not hesitate to call the Templars my friends, it was because he believed that their barbarian mores were gradually being refined by contact with the Orient. "Among the Frange," he explained, "we find some people who have come to settle among us, and who have cultivated the society of the Muslims. They are far superior to those who have freshly joined them in the territories they now occupy. He considered the incident in Al-Aqsa Mosque an instance of the vulgarity of the Frange, and he mentioned others as well, gathered during his frequent visits to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. I happened to be in Tiberias one day when the Frange were celebrating one of their holidays. The knights had come out of the city to engage in a jousting tournament. They brought with them two decrepit old women, whom they stood at one end of the field. At the other end was a pig hung suspended over a rock. The knights then organized a foot race between the two old women. Each one advanced, escorted by a group of knights who obstructed her path. The old women stumbled, fell, and picked themselves up at almost every step, amid loud bursts of laughter from the spectators. Finally, one of the old women, the first to finish, took the pig as the prize for her victory. An emir, as well educated and refined as Usama, was unable to appreciate this burlesque Gallic humor. But his condescending pout shriveled into a grimace of outright disgust when he witnessed what the Frange called justice. In Nablus, he relates, I had the opportunity to witness a curious spectacle. Two men had to meet each other in individual combat. The cause of the fight was this. Some brigands among the Muslims had invaded a neighboring village, and a farmer was suspected of having acted as their guide. He ran away, but was soon forced to return, for King Fulk had imprisoned his children. Treat me fairly, the farmer had asked him, and allow me to compete against my accuser. The king then told the lord who had been granted this village as a fiefdom, bring the man's adversary here. The lord had selected a smith who worked in the village, telling him, it is you who will fight this duel. The possessor of the fiefdom wanted to make sure that none of his peasants would be killed, for fear that his crops would suffer. I looked at this smith. He was a strong young man, but was constantly asking for something to drink, whether he was walking or sitting. As for the accused, he was a courageous old man who stood snapping his fingers in a gesture of defiance. The Viscount, governor of Nablus, approached, gave each man a lance and shield, and had the spectators form a circle around them. The struggle was joined. The old man forced the smith back, pressed him towards the crowd, and then returned to the center of the arena. There was an exchange of blows so violent that the rivals seemed to form a single column of blood. The fight dragged on despite the exhortations of the Viscount, who was anxious to hasten its conclusion. Faster, he shouted at them. The old man was finally exhausted, and the smith, taking advantage of his experience in handling the hammer, dealt him a blow that knocked the old man down and caused him to lose his lance. He then leapt upon him and tried to dig his fingers into his eyes, but he could not manage it, for there was too much blood. The smith then rose and finished off his opponent with a thrust of his lance. A rope was immediately wound around the neck of the corpse, which was dragged to a gallows and hanged. In this example, you may see what justice is among the Frange. The emir's indignation was quite genuine, for justice was a serious business among the Arabs in the 12th century. The judges, or cadis, were highly respected men who were obliged to adhere to a meticulous procedure fixed by the Quran before rendering their verdict. First came indictment, then plea, then testimony. The judgment of God, to which the Occidentals often resorted, seemed a macabre farce to the Arabs. The duel described by the chronicler was only one of the forms of trial by ordeal. The test of fire was another. There was also the water torture, which Usama described with horror. A large cask had been set up and filled with water. The young man who was the object of suspicion was pinioned, suspended from a rope by his shoulder blades, and plunged into the cask. If he was innocent, they said, he would sink into the water, and they would pull him out by the rope. If he was guilty, it would be impossible for him to sink into the water. When he was thrown into the cask, the unfortunate man made every effort to descend to the bottom, but he could not manage it, and thus had to submit to the rigors of their law. May God's curse be upon them. He was then blinded by a red-hot silver awl. The Syrian emir's opinion of the barbarians was hardly modified when he discussed their science. In the 12th century, the Frange lagged far behind the Arabs in all scientific and technical fields. But it was in medicine the gap between the developed East and the primitive West was greatest. Usama observed the difference. One day, he relates, The Frankish governor of Munaitra, in the Lebanese mountains, wrote to my uncle the Sultan, Emir of Shaizar, asking him to send a physician to treat several urgent cases. My uncle selected one of our Christian doctors, a man named Thabit. He was gone for just a few days and then returned home. We were all very curious to know how he had been able to cure the patients so quickly, and we besieged him with questions. Thabit answered, "They brought before me a knight who had an abscess on his leg and a woman suffering from consumption. I made a plaster for the knight, and the swelling opened and improved. For the woman, I prescribed a diet to revive her constitution." But a Frankish doctor then arrived and objected, "This man does not know how to care for them." And addressing the knight, he asked him, "Which do you prefer, to live with one leg or die with two?" When the patient answered that he preferred to live with just one leg, the physician ordered, "Bring me a strong knight with a well-sharpened battle axe." The knight and the axe soon arrived. Frankish doctor placed the man's leg on a chopping block, telling the new arrival, "Strike a sharp blow to cut cleanly." Before my very eyes, the man struck an initial blow, but then, since the leg was still attached, he struck a second time. The marrow of the leg spurted out, and the wounded man died that very instant. As for the woman, the Frankish doctor examined her and said, "She has a demon in her head who has fallen in love with her. Cut her hair." They cut her hair. The woman then began to eat their food again with its garlic and mustard, which aggravated the consumption. Their doctor affirmed, "The devil himself must have entered her head." Then, grasping a razor, he cut an incision in the shape of a cross, exposed the bone of the skull, and rubbed it with salt. The woman died on the spot. I then asked, "Have you any further need of me?" They said no, and I returned home, having learned much that I had never known about the medicine of the Frange. Scandalized as he was by the ignorance of the Occidentals, Usama was even more deeply shocked by their morals. "The Frange," he wrote, "have no sense of honor. If one of them is walking in the street with his wife and encounters another man, that man will take his wife's hand and draw her aside and speak to her, while the husband stands waiting for them to finish their conversation. If it lasts too long, he will leave her with her interlocutor and go off." The emir was troubled. "Imagine this contradiction. These people possess neither jealousy nor honor, whereas they are so courageous." Courage, however, comes only from one sense of honor and from contempt for that which is evil. The more he learned of their ways, the more wretched did Usama consider the Occidentals to be. He admired nothing about them except their martial qualities. One may thus readily understand that when one of the friends he had made among them, a knight in King Fulk's army, proposed to take Usama's young son to Europe to initiate him in the rules of chivalry, the emir politely declined the invitation, muttering under his breath that he would prefer that his son go to prison rather than to the land of the Frange. Fraternization with these foreigners had its limits. Besides the famous collaboration between Damascus and Jerusalem, which had afforded Usama the unexpected opportunity to get to know the Occidentals better, soon appeared as a brief interlude. A spectacular event would now rekindle all-out war against the occupier. On Saturday, the 23rd of September, 1144, the city of Edessa, capital of the oldest of the four Frankish states of the Middle East, fell into the hands of the Atabeg, Khimad al-Dan Zangi. If the fall of Jerusalem in July 1099 marked the climax of the Frankish invasion, and the fall of Tyre in July 1124 the completion of the phase of occupation, the reconquest of Edessa has gone on in history as the capstan of the Arab riposte to the invaders and the beginning of the long march to victory. No one expected that the occupation would be challenged in such a striking manner. Admittedly, Edessa was no more than an outpost of the Frankish presence, but its counts had succeeded in thoroughly integrating themselves into local politics. The last western ruler of this majority Armenian city was Joscelin II, a short, bearded man with a prominent nose, protruding eyes, and a malformed body, a man who had never been known for his courage or wisdom. But he was not detested by his subjects, primarily because his mother was Armenian, and conditions in his realm did not seem at all critical. He and his neighbors indulged in routine raids, which usually ended in truces. But the situation changed dramatically in that autumn of 1144. A clever military maneuver by Zhang Yi put an end to a half century of Frankish domination in this part of the Middle East, as he scored a victory that rocked powerful and humble alike, from Persia to the far-off country of the Alman, and served as a prelude to a fresh invasion led by the greatest kings of the Frange. The most stirring account of the conquest of Edessa was bequeathed to us by an eyewitness, the Syrian bishop Abul Faraj Bazil, who was directly involved in the events. His attitude during the battle graphically illustrates the tragedy of the Oriental Christian communities to which he belonged. Since his city was under attack, Abul Faraj actively participated in its defense. But at the same time, his sympathies were more with the Muslim army than with his Western protectors, whom he did not hold in high esteem. Count Jocelyn, he relates, had gone pillaging along the banks of the Euphrates. Zhang Yi found out. On the 30th of November, he arrived at the walls of Edessa. His troops were as numerous as the stars in the skies. All the fields around the city were filled with them. Tents were erected everywhere, and the Atabeg pitched his own to the north of the city, facing the Gate of Hours, on a hill overlooking the Church of the Confessors. Even though it lay in a valley, Edessa was a difficult city to take, for its powerful triangular walls were solidly anchored in the hills ringing the town. But, as Abul Faraj explains, Jocelyn had not left any troops behind. He had only shoemakers, weavers, silk merchants, tailors, and priests. It was therefore the Frankish bishop who took charge of the defense of the city, with the help of an Armenian prelate and the chronicler himself, who, however, favored reaching some accommodation with the Atabeg. Zhang Yi, he writes, constantly sent peace proposals to the besieged, telling them, "Oh, unfortunate people, you can see that all hope is lost. What do you want? What can you still expect? Have pity on yourselves, your women, your homes. Act now that your city may not be devastated and emptied of its inhabitants." But there was no commander in the city capable of imposing his will. Zhang Yi was answered with stupid rodomontade and insult. When he saw that sappers were tunneling under the ramparts, Abul Faraj suggested writing a letter to Zhang Yi proposing a truce, and the Frankish bishop agreed. The letter was written and read to the people, but a madman, a silk merchant, reached out, grabbed the letter, and tore it up. Nevertheless, Zhang Yi reiterated, "If you desire a truce for several days, we will accord you one, to see whether you will receive any aid. If you do not, surrender and survive." But no help arrived. Although Jocelyn had been alerted to the offensive against his capital, he did not dare match forces with the Atabeg. He preferred to camp at Tel Bashir, expecting that troops from Antioch or Jerusalem would come to his aid. The Turks had now dismantled the foundations of the northern wall, and in their place had erected great quantities of wood, joists, and beams. They filled the interstices with naphtha, animal fat, and sulfur, so fire would spread more easily and the wall would collapse. Then, on Zangi's orders, the fire was started. The heralds of his camp gave the call to prepare for battle, telling the soldiers to rush in through the breach as soon as the wall collapsed, promising to allow them to pillage the city at will for 3 days. The fire caught in the naphtha and sulfur, and soon the wood and melted fat were in flames. The northerly wind was blowing the smoke towards the defenders. In spite of its great solidity, the wall tottered, then collapsed. After losing many troops passing through the breach, the Turks penetrated the city and began massacring people indiscriminately. About 6,000 inhabitants perished on that day. Women, children, and young people fled to the upper citadel to escape the massacre. They found the gate barred, the fault of the bishop of the Frange, who had told the guards, "Do not open the gate unless you see my face." Groups of people climbed up in succession, trampling one another. It was a lamentable and horrifying spectacle. About 5,000 people, perhaps more, died atrociously, twisted, suffocating, pressed together into a single compact mass. But Zhang Yi interfered personally to halt the killing, and then dispatched his top lieutenant to see Abul Faraj. "Venerable Abul Faraj," he said, "we want you to swear to us, on the cross and the New Testament, that you and your community will remain loyal. You know very well that this city was a thriving metropolis during the 200 years that the Arabs governed it. Today, the Franj have occupied it for just 50 years, and already they have ruined it. Our master, Khimad al-Din Zanghi, is prepared to treat you well. Live in peace, be secure under his authority, and pray for his life. In fact, Abu al-Faraj continued, the Syrians and Armenians were brought out of the citadel, and they all returned to their homes safe and sound. Everything was taken from the Franj, however, gold, silver, holy vases, chalices, patens, ornamented crucifixes, and great quantities of jewels. The priests, nobles, and notables were taken aside, stripped of their robes, and led away in chains to Aleppo. Of the rest, the artisans were identified, and Zanghi kept them as prisoners, setting each to work at his craft. All the other Franj, about 100 men, were executed. When news of the reconquest of Edessa spread, the Arab world was gripped with enthusiasm. The most ambitious projects were attributed to Zanghi. The refugees from Palestine and the many coastal cities in the Atabeg's entourage had already begun to speak of the reconquest of Jerusalem, an objective that would soon become the rallying cry for resistance to the Franj. The caliph lost no time in heaping prestigious titles upon the hero of the moment, Al-Malik Al-Mansur, victorious king, Zainat al-Islam, ornament of Islam, Nasi Amir al-Mu'min, protector of the prince of the faithful. Like all leaders of the time, Zanghi proudly strung these various titles together as symbols of his power. In a subtly satirical note, Ibn al-Qalanisi asks readers of his chronicle to excuse him for writing merely Sultan, Emir, or Atabeg such and such, without appending the full lists of titles. For he explains there had been such a proliferation of honorific titles since the 10th century that his text would have become unreadable had he tried to list them all. Discreetly lamenting the epoch of the first caliphs, who were content with the title Prince of the Faithful, superb in its simplicity, the Damascene chronicler cites a few examples to illustrate his point, Zanghi himself among them. Ibn al-Qalanisi recalls that every time he mentions Zanghi, he ought, strictly speaking, to say, the Emir, the General, the Great, the Just, the Aid of God, the Triumphant, the Unique, the Pillar of Religion, the Cornerstone of Islam, Ornament of Islam, Protector of God's Creatures, Associate of the Dynasty, Auxiliary of Doctrine, Grandeur of the Nation, Honor of Kings, Supporter of Sultans, Victor over the Infidels, Rebels, and Atheists, Commander of the Muslim armies, the victorious king, the king of princes, the son of the deserving, emir of the two Iraqs and of Syria, conqueror of Iran, Balawan, Jihan Alp, Inasaj Kotloch, Tohrulbeg, Atabeg, Abu Sahkid, Zanghi ibn Aksunkor, protector of the prince of the faithful. Whatever their pompous character, at which the Damascene chronicler smiles irreverently, these titles nevertheless reflected the primordial place Zanghi now held in the Arab world. The Franj trembled at the very mention of his name. Their disarray was all the greater, in that King Fulk had died shortly before the fall of Edessa, leaving 2 children who were both minors. His wife, who assured the continuity of the crown, quickly sent emissaries to the land of the Franj to bring news of the disaster that had just befallen his people. In all their territories, Ibn al-Qalanisi writes, calls were issued for people to assemble for an assault on the land of Islam. As if to confirm the fears of the Occidentals, Zanghi returned to Syria after his victory, giving rise to rumors that he was preparing a broad offensive against the major cities held by the Franj. At first, these projects were greeted with enthusiasm in the cities of Syria, but gradually the Damascenes began to wonder about the Atabeg's real intentions. For he had settled in Baalbek, just as he had done in 1139, and was busy building siege machinery. Was it not perhaps Damascus itself that he intended to attack, using the jihad as a pretext? We will never know, for in January 1146, just as his preparations for a spring offensive seemed complete, Zanghi found himself compelled to turn north again. His spies had informed him that a plot to massacre the Turkish garrison had been hatched by Joscelin of Odessa and some of his Armenian friends who had remained in the city. The Atabeg took the situation in hand immediately upon his return to the conquered city, executing the supporters of the former count. Then, In an effort to strengthen the anti-Frange party within the population, he moved in 300 Jewish families of whose indefectible support he was certain. This alert, however, convinced Zangi that it would be better to renounce any attempt to extend his domain, temporarily at least, and to concentrate on consolidating it instead. In particular, an Arab emir who controlled the powerful fortress of Jabba, situated on the Euphrates along the main route from Aleppo to Mosul, had refused to recognize the Atabeg's authority. Since this insubordination could easily threaten communications between Zangi's two capitals, he laid siege to Jabba in June 1146. He hoped to take it in a few days, but the enterprise proved more difficult than expected. 3 long months passed, and the resistance of the besieged forces failed to weaken. One night in September, the Atabeg fell asleep after imbibing a great quantity of alcohol. Suddenly, he was awakened by a noise in his tent. When he opened his eyes, he saw one of his eunuchs, a man of Frankish origin named Yarankash, drinking wine from his own goblet. This infuriated the Atabeg, who swore he would punish the eunuch severely the following day. Fearing the wrath of his master, Yarankash waited for him to fall asleep again, and then riddled his body with dagger strokes and fled to Jabba, where gifts were lavished upon him. Zangi did not die immediately. As he lay half-conscious, one of his close aides entered his tent. Ibn al-Atir reports his testimony. "When he saw me, the Atabeg thought that I had come to finish him off, and with a gesture of his finger, he asked for the coup de grâce. Choked with emotion, I fell to my knees and said to him, 'Master, who did this to you?' But he was unable to answer, and gave up his soul. May God have mercy upon him." Zangi's tragic death, coming so soon after his triumph, made a deep impression on his contemporaries. Ibn al-Qalanisi commented on the event in verse. "The morning found him sprawled upon his bed, lying where his eunuch had slaughtered him, and yet he slumbered amidst a proud army, ringed by his braves with their swords. He perished, neither riches nor power of use to him, his treasures now the prey of others, by his sons and adversaries dismembered. At his death did his enemies ride forth, grasping the swords they dared not brandish while he lived." Indeed, when Zangi died, there was a mad dash for the spoils. His soldiers, so well disciplined only a short time ago, now became a horde of uncontrollable plunderers. His treasury, his arsenal, even his personal effects disappeared in the twinkling of an eye. Then his army began to break up. One after another, the emirs assembled their men and hurried off to occupy some fortress or to await the sequel of events from some more secure position. When Muhin al-Din Huna learned of the death of his adversary, he immediately led his troops out of Damascus and seized Baalbek, re-establishing his suzerainty over all of central Syria in a few weeks. Raimond of Antioch, reviving what seemed a forgotten tradition, launched a raid under the very walls of Aleppo. Jocelyn was plotting to retake Edessa. The saga of the powerful state founded by Zangi seemed over. In reality, it had only just begun. Part 4. Victory. 1146 to 1187. May God grant victory to Islam and not to Mahmud. Who is this dog Mahmud to merit victory? Nur al-Din Mahmud, Unifier of the Arab East, 1117 to 1174. Chapter 8. Nur al-Din, the Saint King. Only one man remained unruffled amidst the confusion that reigned in Zangi's camp. He was 29 years old, a tall man with dark skin, clean-shaven but for a goatee, his forehead broad, his expression gentle and serene. He approached the still warm body of the Atabeg and, trembling, took his hand and removed his signet ring, symbol of power, slipping it onto his own finger. His name was Nur al-Din, Zangi's second son. "I have read the biographies of the sovereigns of old, and other than among the first caliphs, I have found no man as virtuous and just as Nur al-Din." Ibn al-Atir virtually worshipped this prince, and with good reason. For although Zangi's son had inherited his father's qualities of austerity, courage, and statesmanship, he had none of the defects that made the Atabeg so odious to some of his contemporaries. Where Zangi struck fright with his truculence and complete lack of scruples, Nur al-Din, from his very first appearance on the scene, managed to cultivate the image of a pious, reserved, and just man, one who kept his word and was thoroughly devoted to the jihad against the enemies of Islam. Even more important, and herein lay his genius, he was able to weld these virtues into a formidable political weapon. As far back as the middle of the 12th century, he understood the invaluable role of psychological mobilization, and he therefore built a genuine propaganda apparatus. Several hundred men of letters, religious figures for the most part, were entrusted with the mission of winning the active sympathy of the people and of thereby forcing the leaders of the Arab world to flock to his banner. Ibn al-Athir reports the complaint of an emir of Jazira who was invited by the son of Zangi to participate in a campaign against the Frange. "If I do not rush to Nur al-Din's aid," the emir said, "he will strip me of my domain, for he has already written to the devotees and ascetics to request the aid of their prayers and to encourage them to incite the Muslims to jihad. At this very moment, each of these men sits with his disciples and companions, reading Nur al-Din's letters, weeping and cursing me. If I am to avoid anathema, I must accede to his request." Nur al-Din supervised his corps of propagandists personally. He would commission poems, letters, and books, and always take care that they were released at the time when they would produce the desired effect. The principles he preached were simple: a single religion, Sunni Islam, which meant a determined struggle against all the various heresies. A single state that would encircle the Frange on all fronts. A single objective, jihad, to reconquer the occupied territories and above all to liberate Jerusalem. During his 28-year reign, Nur al-Din would call upon various ulama to write treatises hailing the merits of al-Quds, the holy city, and public readings were organized in the mosques and schools. On these occasions, no one ever omitted to eulogize the supreme mujahid, the irreproachable Muslim Nur al-Din. But this cult of the personality was unusually effective and clever, in that it was based, paradoxically, on the humility and austerity of the son of Zangi. According to Ibn al-Athir, Nur al-Din's wife once complained that she did not have enough money to provide adequately for his needs. He had assigned her three shops which he owned in Homs. These generated about 20 dinars a year. When she found that this was not enough, he retorted, "I have nothing else. With all the money I command, I am but the treasurer of the Muslims, and I have no intention of betraying them, nor of casting myself into the fires of hell on your account." Such words, very widely broadcast, proved especially embarrassing to the princes of the region, who lived in luxury and squeezed their subjects to wring every last pittance out of them. In fact, Nur al-Din's propaganda laid heavy emphasis on the taxes he abolished in the lands subject to his authority. If he embarrassed his adversaries, the son of Zangi was often no less exacting with his own emirs. As time went on, he became increasingly strict about religious precepts. Not content with forswearing alcohol himself, he forbade his army to partake in it, or to have any truck with the tambourine, the flute, and other objects displeasing to God. As Kamal el-Din, the chronicler of Aleppo, explains, adding, "Nur al-Din abandoned luxurious garments and instead covered himself with rough cloth." The Turkish officers, who were accustomed to heavy drinking and sumptuous adornments, were not always comfortable with this master who smiled so rarely and whose favorite company seemed to be turbaned ulama. Even less reassuring to the emirs was the son of Zangi's tendency to dispense with his title, Nur al-Din, light of religion, in favor of his first name, Mahmud. "O God," he would pray before battle, "grant victory to Islam and not to Mahmud. Who is this dog Mahmud to merit victory?" Such manifestations of humility won him the sympathy of the weak and pious, but the powerful considered them simply hypocritical. It appears, however, that he was sincere in his convictions, although his public image was undoubtedly confected in part. In any event, he obtained results. It was Nur al-Din who turned the Arab world into a force capable of crushing the Frange, and it was his lieutenant Saladin who reaped the fruits of victory. Upon the death of his father, Nur al-Din succeeded in assuming control of Aleppo, not much compared to the enormous domain conquered by the Atabeg, but the very modesty of his initial realm itself assured the glory of his reign. Zangi had spent most of his life fighting against the caliphs, sultans, and various emirates of Iraq and Jazira. His son would be unencumbered by this exhausting and ungrateful task. leaving Mosul and its adjoining region to his older brother, Saif al-Din, with whom he maintained cordial relations, thereby ensuring that he could count on a powerful friend on his eastern border, Nur al-Din devoted himself to Syrian affairs. Nevertheless, his position was far from comfortable when he arrived in Aleppo in September 1146, accompanied by his close confidant, the Kurdish emir Sirkuh, uncle of Saladin. Once again, the city lived in fear of the Knights of Antioch, and at the end of October, even before Nur al-Din had had time to establish his authority beyond the city walls, he was told that Joscelin had succeeded in retaking Edessa with the aid of part of the Armenian population. Edessa was not just one more city like those that had been lost since the death of Zangi. It was the very symbol of the Atabeg's glory, and its fall imperiled the whole future of the dynasty. Nur al-Din reacted swiftly. Riding day and night, abandoning exhausted mounts along the way, he arrived at Edessa before Joscelin had had time to organize a defense. The count, whose courage had not been bolstered by his past ordeals, decided to flee at nightfall. His supporters, who tried to follow him, were caught and massacred by the Aleppan cavalry. The rapidity with which the insurrection had been crushed brought the son of Zangi fresh prestige, of which his nascent regime had great need. Drawing the lesson, Raimond of Antioch became less enterprising. As for Hunah, he quickly offered the ruler of Aleppo the hand of his daughter in marriage. The marriage contract was drafted in Damascus, Ibn al-Qalansi explains, in the presence of Nur al-Din's envoys. Work on the trousseau began immediately, and as soon as it was ready, the envoys left to return to Aleppo. Nur al-Din's position in Syria was apparently secure, but Joscelin's plots, Raymond's trials, and the intrigues of the old folk in Damascus would soon seem derisory compared to the fresh danger now looming. Reports kept coming in from Constantinople, from the territory of the Frange, and from neighboring lands too, that the kings of the Frange were on their way from their countries to attack the land of Islam. They had emptied their own provinces, leaving them devoid of defenders, and had brought with them riches, treasures, and immeasurable materiel. They numbered, it was said, as many as 1 million foot soldiers and cavalry, perhaps even more. Ibn al-Qalanisi was 75 when he wrote those lines, and he undoubtedly remembered that he had had to report a similar event in scarcely different terms half a century before. Indeed, from the outset, the second Frankish invasion, provoked by the fall of Edessa, seemed a repetition of the first. Countless fighters were unleashed against Asia Minor in the autumn of 1147, and once again they bore on their backs the two strips of cloth sewn into the form of a cross. As they passed Dorylaeum, where the historic defeat of Kilijahzlan had occurred, the latter's son, Mas'ud, was waiting for them, seeking revenge 50 years on. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.